spider, sapping all her strength until it got what it needed to seal itself and permit the heart to go on beating. She was acquainted with it, had thought marrying K.D. would permanently heal it. But now, waiting for we are gathered here, anxious for do you take this, she knew better, knew exactly what was and would always be missing. Say it, please, she urged. Please, and hurry, hurry. I've got things to do. Billy Delia shifted her bouquet from her left hand to her right. Tiny thorns pricked through her white cotton gloves, and the freesia blossoms were closing as she'd known they would. Only the tea roses remained sturdy, with promises you could count on to be kept. She had suggested baby's breath to flatter the yellow buds, but was astonished to find that not one garden had any, no baby's breath anywhere. Then yarrow, she said, but the bride refused to carry to her wedding a weed that cattle ate. So there they were, both of them, holding water-hungry freesia and tea roses improperly dethorned. Other than the damage being done to her palms, the weight Reverend Meisner was forcing on everybody did not bother or surprise her. It was just one more piece of foolishness that made up this foolish wedding that everybody thought was a ceasefire. But the war was not between the Morgans, the Fleetwoods, and those who sided with either. It was true that Jeff had taken to carrying a handgun, that Steward Morgan and Arnold Fleetwood had shouted at each other in the street, that people wandered into Anna Flood's back room to lounge in Menace's barber shop, not for haircuts, but to grunt and sigh over the rumor of an outrage that had taken place out at the convent. That, based on this gossip, Reverend Pulliam had preached in a sermon taken from Jeremiah 1:5. Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee. Reverend Meisner countered with Paul's words to the Corinthians. The greatest of these is love. But to Billy Delia, the real battle was not about infant life or a bride's reputation, but about disobedience, which meant, of course, the stallions were fighting about who controlled the mares and their foals. Senior Pulliam had scripture and history on his side. Meisner had scripture and the future on his. Now, she supposed, he was making the world wait until it understood his position. Billy Delia lowered her gaze from Meisner's searching eyes to the heavy lace on the bride's head, to the back of the groom's neck, and thought immediately of a horse she once loved. Although it was the groom who held in his name the memory of a legendary horse race, it was she whose life had been maimed by it. Hardgoods, the winning horse that K.D. had ridden when Ruby was founded, belonged to Mr. Nathan Dupre. Years after that race, but before she could walk, Mr. Nathan had hoisted her on Hardgoods' bare back, which she rode with such glee it made everybody laugh. From then on, every month or so, when he came into town on errands, he unsaddled the horse and led it around the schoolyard next to her house, holding her waist with the palm of his hand. Mount up these children, he would say. Need more horsewomen in this land. Everybody crying for a motor car better mount up their children early. Hardgoods ain't never had a flat. It continued until Billy Delia was 3 years old. too little still for everyday underwear, and nobody noticed or cared how perfect her skin felt against that wide expanse of rhythmically moving animal flesh. While she struggled to grip hard goods with her ankles and endure the rub of his spine, the grown-up smiled, taking pleasure in her pleasure, while calling Mr. Nathan a retrograde Negro who needed to learn how to shift gears so he could get somewhere on time. Then one day, a Sunday, hard goods came loping down the streets with Mr. Nathan astride. Billy Delia, who hadn't seen horse or rider for a long while, ran toward them, begging for a lift. Mr. Nathan promised to stop by after service. Still in her Sunday clothes, she waited in her yard. When she saw him coming, negotiating space among the after-church crowd, she ran out into the middle of Central Avenue, where she pulled down her Sunday panties before raising her arms to be lifted onto Hard Goods' back. Things seemed to crumple after that. She got an unintelligible whipping from her mother and a dose of shame it took her years to understand. That's when the teasing began, more merciless because her mother was the teacher. Suddenly, there was a dark light in the eyes of boys who felt comfortable staring at her. Suddenly, a curious bracing in the women, a looking away look in the men, and a permanent watchfulness in her mother. Nathan Dupre did not make her another offer. Hard Goods was lost to her forever, remembered publicly as the horse that won the race with K.D. on his back, privately as the recipient of a little girl's shame. Only Mrs. Dovey Morgan and her sister Soane treated her with easy kindness, stopping her in the street to adjust the bow in her braids, praising her work in their kitchen gardens, and once, when Mrs. Dovey Morgan stopped her to wipe what she thought was makeup from Billy Delia's rosy lips, she did it with a smile and no hateful lecture, even apologized when her handkerchief came away clean. If it had not been for them and Anna Flood's return, her teens would have been unlivable. Nor did Anna or the Morgan ladies make her feel the freakishness of being an only child, perhaps because they had few or no children themselves. Most families boasted 9, 11, even 15 children, and it was inevitable that she and Arnett, who had no sisters and just one brother, become best friends. She knew people took her for the wild one, the one who, from the beginning, not only had no qualms about pressing her nakedness on a horse's back, but preferred it, would drop her drawers in public on Sunday just to get the thrill of it, although it was Arnett who had sex at 14 with the groom. Billy Delia had carried the burden. She quickly learned the cautionary look in the eyes of girls whose mothers had warned them away from Billy Delia. In fact, she was untouched so far. Since she was helplessly in love with a pair of brothers, her virginity, which no one believed existed, had become as mute as the cross Reverend Meisner was holding aloft. Now his eyes were closed, his jaw muscles working overtime. He held the cross as though it were a hammer he was trying not to bring down lest it hurt somebody. Billy Delia wished he would open his eyes again, look at the groom, and bust him over the head with it. But no, that would embarrass the bride who had won, finally, the husband her maid of honor despised. A husband who had propositioned Billy Delia before and after his thing with Arnett. a husband who, while Annette was away, had forgotten all about her and chased any dress whose wearer was under 50. A husband who had left his future bride pregnant and on her own, knowing that it was the unmarried mother-to-be, not the father-to-be, who would have to ask her church's forgiveness. Billy Delia had heard of such things. But any girl who got pregnant in Ruby could count on marriage, whether the boy was eager or not, because he still had to live near her family and with his own. Still had to meet her in church or anywhere else he turned. But not this groom. This groom let the bride suffer for 4 years and consented to a wedding only when he was kicked out of another woman's bed. Kicked so hard he couldn't get to the altar fast enough. She remembered vividly the day the kicker had arrived in shoes already designed for the groom's behind. Billy Delia's hatred of the strange-looking girl was instant and would have been eternal had she not taken refuge in the convent herself one chilly October day after a quarrel with her mother turned ugly. Her mother fought her like a man that day. She had run to Anna Flood, who told her to wait upstairs while she dealt with some delivery man business. Billy Delia cried alone for what seemed like hours, licking her split lip and touching the swelling under her eye. When she spied Apollo's truck, she slipped down the back stairs, and while he was buying soda pop, she got into the cab. Neither of them knew what to do. Apollo offered to take her out to his family's place, but ashamed of having to explain her face to his parents and put up with the stares of any one of his 12 brothers and sisters, she asked him to drive her out to the convent. That was the fall of 1973. What she saw and learned there changed her forever. Agreeing to be Arnett's maid of honor was the last sentimental thing she would ever do in Ruby. She got a job in Denby, bought a car, and probably would have driven it to St. Louis, except for her helpless double love. With or without chaw in his mouth, Stewart was not a patient man. So he was surprised to find himself calm, watching Meisner's behavior. All around him, the congregation had begun to murmur, exchange looks, but Stewart, believing he was less confounded than they were, did neither, in spite of no soothing wad of tobacco. As a small boy, he had listened to Big Daddy describe a 65-mile journey he'd taken to bring supplies back to Haven. It was 1920. State prohibition was now national. A sickness called rocking pneumonia gripped Haven, and Big Daddy was one of the few able bodies able to go. He went alone, on horseback. He got what he needed in Logan County, and with the medicines bundled under his coat, the other supplies tied to his horse, he lost his way and found himself after sunset unsure of which way to go. He smelled, but could not see, a campfire that seemed to be fairly close by on his left. Then suddenly, to his right, he heard whoops, music, and gunshots, but he saw no lights in that direction. Stuck in darkness, with invisible strangers on both sides, he had to decide whether to ride toward the smoke and meat smells or toward the music and guns, or neither. The campfire might be warming robbers. The music might be amusing lynchers, his horse decided. Smelling others of its kind, it trotted toward the campfire. There, Big Daddy found 3 sack and fox men sitting near a fire hidden in a hole. He dismounted, approached carefully, hat in hand, and said, "Evening." The men welcomed him, and learning of his destination, warned him against entering the town. "The women there fight with their fists," they said. "The children are drunk. The men don't argue or debate, but speak only with firearms. Liquor laws don't apply." They had come to rescue a family member who had been drinking in there for 12 days. Already one of them was in there searching for him. "What's the name of the town?" Big Daddy asked. "Pura Sangre," they answered. At its northern edge was a sign, "No niggers." At its southern edge, a cross. Big Daddy spent several hours with them, and before light, thanked them and left, backtracking to find his way home. When Seward heard the story the first time, he could not close his mouth, thinking of that moment when his father was all alone in the dark, guns to the right, strangers to the left, but the grown-ups laughed and thought of something else. No niggers at one end, a cross at the other, and the devil loose in between. Stewart didn't get it. How could the devil be anywhere near a cross? What was the connection between the two signs? Since that time, however, he had seen crosses between the titties of whores, military crosses spread for miles, crosses on fire in Negroes' yards, crosses tattooed on the forearms of dedicated killers. He had seen a cross dangling from the rear-view mirror of a car full of whites come to insult the little girls of Ruby. Whatever Reverend Meisner was thinking, he was wrong. A cross was no better than the bearer. Now, Stewart fingered his mustache, aware of his twin, shifting his feet, getting ready to grab the pew in front of him and put a stop to Meisner's behavior. Sohn, sitting next to Deke, listening to his heavy breathing, understood how grave her mistake. She was about to touch her husband on the arm to caution him from rising when Meisner lowered the cross at last and spoke the opening words of the ceremony. Deke sat back and cleared his sinuses, but the damage was done. They were right back where they'd started when Jefferson Fleetwood pulled a gun on KD, when Menace had to interrupt a pushing match between Stewart and Arnold, and when Mabel had sent no cake to the all-church bake sale. The peace and goodwill summoned by the announcement of the marriage were now shattered. The reception at her house would be a further digest of the problem, and most disturbing, Sohn, unbeknownst to others, had made the mistake of inviting Connie and the convent girls to the wedding reception. Having misread the warning, she was about to hostess one of the biggest messes Ruby had ever seen. Both of her dead sons were leaning against the Kelvinator, cracking the shells of Spanish peanuts. "What's that in the sink?" Easter asked her. She looked down and saw feathers, brightly colored but small, like chicken feathers, lying in a heap in her sink. It made her wonder. She hadn't killed or plucked any fowl and would never have put feathers there. "I don't know," she answered. "You should gather them up, Mama," Scout told her. "That's no place for them, you know." They both laughed and crunched the nuts. She woke, wondering what kind of bird was colored that way. When pairs and pairs of buzzards flew over the town, she thought that was the significance of the dream, that no matter what, this marriage would fix nothing. Now she believed her sons had tried to tell her something else. She'd been concentrating on the colors, while the point was the sink. "That's no place for them, you know," the strange feathers she had invited did not belong in her house. When finally Kate Golightly touched the organ keys and the couple turned around to face the congregation, Soane cried, partly at the sad, bright smiles of the bride and groom, partly in dread of the malice set roaming now and on its way to her house. It had long been noticed that the Morgan brothers seldom spoke to or looked at each other. Some believed it was because they were jealous of one another, that their views only seemed to be uniform, that down deep was a mutual resentment which surfaced in small ways, in their automobile arguments, for example, one's fierce preference for Chevrolets, the other's stubborn defense of Oldsmobiles. In fact, the brothers not only agreed on almost everything, they were in eternal, if silent, conversation. Each knew the other's thoughts as well as he knew his face, and only once in a while needed the confirmation of a glance. Now they stood in different rooms of Deke's house, thinking the same thing. Fortunately, Meisner was late, Minnis sober, Pulliam triumphant, and Jeff preoccupied with Sweetie. Mabel, who had attended the ceremony, had relieved her daughter-in-law for the reception. The wedding couple were in line, glazed smiles in place, but in line nevertheless. Pastor Carey, soothing and jovial, was the best bet for keeping things steady. He and his wife, Lily, were treasured for their duets, and if they could get some music going. Stewart opened the piano while Deke moved through the guests. As he passed Reverend Pulliam, nodding and smiling with Sweetie and Jeff, Deke gave him a reassuring pat on the shoulder. In the dining room, the food table drew appreciative murmurs, but as yet no takers except children. The coos over the gift table seemed strained, excessive. Stewart waited at the piano, his steel-gray hair and innocent eyes in perfect balance. The children around him shone like agate. The women were brilliant, but quiet in their still fresh Easter clothes. The men's squeaky new shoes glistened like melon seeds. Everyone was stiff, overly polite. Deke must be having trouble persuading the Careys, he thought. Stewart reached for tobacco, silently urging his twin to try somebody else, the male chorus. Kate Golightly, quick, before Pulliam took it in his head to pray them back into battle stations. Or, Lord help us, Jeff began reciting his VA grievances. Once that started, his next target would be KD, who had never served in the military. Where is Soane? He wondered. Stewart could see Dovey unpinning the veil from the bride's hair, and his innocent eyes enjoyed his wife's figure once more. In anything, Sunday dress, white church uniform, or even his own bathrobe, the look of her body made him smile with satisfaction. But Deke was cautioning him now about distraction, so Seward left off admiring Dovey and saw the success of his brother's efforts. Kate came toward the piano and sat down. She flexed her fingers and began to play. First, a preparatory trill, accompanied by friendly coughs and murmurs of anticipation. Then Simon and Lily Carey arrived, humming, while they considered what to begin with. They were a third of the way into Precious Lord, Take My Hand. Smiles had turned toward the direction of the music when they heard the horn blast of an ancient Cadillac. Connie did not come, but her boarders did. Mavis drove the Cadillac, with Gigi and Seneca in the back, and a somebody new in the passenger seat. None of them was dressed for a wedding. They piled out of the car looking like go-go girls, pink shorts, skimpy tops, see-through skirts, painted eyes, no lipstick, obviously no underwear, no stockings. Jezebel's storehouse, raided to decorate arms, earlobes, necks, ankles, and even a nostril. Mavis and Soane, greeting each other on the lawn, were uncomfortable. Two other women sauntered into the dining room and surveyed the food tables. They said hi and wondered aloud if there was anything other than lemonade and punch to drink. There wasn't, so they did what a few other young people had already done, drifted out of the Morgan's yard and strolled past Anna Flood's store to the oven. The few local girls already there clumped together and withdrew, leaving the territory to the pool boys, Apollo, Rude, and Hurston, to the Seawrights, Timothy Jr. and Spider, to Destry, Vane, and Royal. Menace joined them, but Jeff, to whom he had been speaking, did not. Neither did the watching groom. Dovey was removing the fat from a lamb slice when the music hit. She cut her finger in the blare and sucked it when Otis Redding screamed, "Aw, little girl," obliterating the hymn's quiet plea. Inside, outside, and on down the road, the beat and the heat were ruthless. "Oh, they're just having fun," a voice behind Reverend Pulliam whispered. He turned to look, but could not locate the speaker, so he continued glaring out of the window. He knew about such women, like children, always on the lookout for fun, devoted to it, but always needing a break in order to have it, a lift, a hand, a $5 bill, somebody to excuse or coddle them, somebody to look down at the ground and say nothing when they disturbed the peace. He exchanged glances with his wife, who nodded and left the window. She knew, as he did, that fun-obsessed adults were clear signs of already advanced decay. Soon the whole country would be awash in toys, toned deaf from raucous music and hollow laughter. But not here, not in Ruby, not while Senior Pulliam was alive. The convent girls are dancing, throwing their arms over their heads. They do this and that and then the other. They grin and yip, but look at no one, just their own rocking bodies. The local girls look over their shoulders and snort. Rude, Apollo, and Spider, steel-muscled farm boys with sophisticated eyes, sway and snap their fingers. Hurston sings accompaniment. Two small girls ride their bikes over. Wide-eyed, they watch the dancing women. One of them, with amazing hair, asks, can she borrow a bike? Then another. They ride the bikes down Central Avenue with no regard for what the breeze does to their long, flowered skirts or how pumping pedals plump their breasts. One coasts with her ankles on the handlebars. Another rides the handlebars with Brood on the seat behind her. One, in the world's shortest pink shorts, is seated on a bench, arms wrapped around herself. She looks drunk. Are they all? The boys laugh. Anna and Kate carry their plates to the edge of Soane's garden.
Which one?
Whispered Anna. That one there, said Kate. The one with the rag for a blouse? That's a halter, said Anna. Halter? Looks like a starter to me. She the one KD was messing with?
Yep.
I know that one there. She comes in the store. Who the other two? Beats me. Look, there goes Billy Delia. Naturally. Oh, come on, Kate. Leave Billy alone. They spooned potato salad into their mouths. Behind them came Alice Pulliam, murmuring, my, 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 my. Hello, Aunt Alice, said Kate. Have you ever in your life seen such carrying on? Bet you can't locate one brassiere in the whole bunch. Alice held the crown of her hat in the breeze. Why are you all smiling? I don't think this is the least bit funny.
No, of course not, said Kate.
This is a wedding, remember? You're right, Aunt Alice. I said you're right. How would you like to have somebody dancing nasty at your wedding? Alice's bright black eyes searched Anna's hair. Kate nodded sympathetically while pressing her lips tight so no smile could seep through them. Anna tried to look seriously affronted before this stern preacher's wife, thinking, dear Jesus, I wouldn't last an hour in this town if I married Richard. I'm going to have to get Pastor himself to stop this, Alice said, and moved resolutely off toward Soane's house. Anna and Kate waited several beats before setting their laughter free. Whatever else, thought Anna, the convent women had saved the day. Nothing like other folks' sins for distraction. The young people were wrong. Be the furrow of her brow. Speaking of which, where was Richard anyway? Down on his knees, Richard Meisner was angry at his anger and at his mishandling of it. Used to obstacles, adept at disagreement, he could not reconcile the level of his present fury with what seemed to be its source. He loved God so much it hurt, although that same love sometimes made him laugh out loud, and he deeply respected his colleagues. For centuries, they had held on, preaching, shouting, dancing, singing, absorbing, arguing, counseling, pleading, commanding. Their passion burned or smoldered like lava over a land that had waged war against them and their flock without surcease, a lily-livered war without honor as either its point or reward, an unprincipled war that thrived as much on the victor's cowardice as on his mendacity. On stage and in print, he and his brethren had been the heart of comedy, the chosen backs for parody's knife. They were cursed by death row inmates, derided by pimps, begrudged even miserly collection plates. Yet through all of that, if the spirit seemed to be slipping away, they had held on to it with their teeth, if they had to, grabbing it in their fists, if need be. They took it to buildings ready to be condemned, to churches from which white congregations had fled, to quilt tents, to ravines and logs in clearings, whispered it in cabins lit by moonlight, lest the law see. Prayed for it behind trees and in sod houses, their voices undaunted by roaring winds. From Abyssinian to storefronts, from Pilgrim Baptist to abandoned movie houses, in polished shoes, worn boots, beat-up cars, and Lincoln Continentals, well-fed or malnourished, they let their light flickering low or blazing like a comet pierced the darkness of days. They wiped white folks' spit from the faces of black children, hid strangers from posses and police, relayed life-preserving information faster than the newspaper and better than the radio. At sick beds, they looked death in the eye and mouth. They pressed the heads of weeping mothers to their shoulders before conducting their life-gouged daughters to the cemetery. They wept for chain gangs, reasoned with magistrates, made whole congregations scream in ecstasy, in belief that death was life, don't you know, and every life, don't you know, was holy, don't you know, in his eyesight. Rocked as they were by the sight of evil, its snout was familiar to them. Real wonder, however, lay in the amazing shapes and substances God's grace took, gospel in times of persecution, the exquisite winds of people forbidden to compete, the upright righteousness of those who let no boot hold them down, people who made Job's patience look like restlessness, elegance when all around was shabby. Richard Meisner knew all that. Yet, however intact his knowledge and respect, the tremor inside him now was ungovernable. Pulliam had fingered a membrane enclosing a ravenous appetite for vengeance, an appetite he needed to understand in order to subdue. Had the times finally gotten to him? Was the desolation that rose after King's murder a desolation that climbed like a tidal wave in slow motion just now washing over him? Or was it the calamity of watching the drawn-out abasement of a noxious president? Had the long, unintelligible war infected him? Behaving like a dormant virus in blossom now? That it was coming to a raggedy close? Everybody on his high school football team died in that war. 11 broad-backed boys. They were the ones he had looked up to, wanted to be like. Was he just now gagging at their futile death? Was that the origin of this incipient hunger for violence? Or was it Ruby? What was it about this town, these people, that enraged him? They were different from other communities in only a couple of ways, beauty and isolation. All of them were handsome, some exceptionally so. Except for three or four, they were coal black, athletic, with noncommittal eyes. All of them maintained an icy suspicion of outsiders. Otherwise, they were, like all small black communities, protective, God-loving, thrifty, but not miserly. They saved and spent, liked money in the bank and nice things, too. When he arrived, he thought their flaws were normal, their disagreements ordinary. They were pleased by the accomplishments of their neighbors, and their mockery of the lazy and the loose was full of laughter, or used to be. Now it seemed the glacial wariness they once confined to strangers more and more was directed toward each other. Had he contributed to it? He could not help admitting that without his presence, there would probably be no contention, no painted fists. No quarrels about missing language on an oven's lip. No warnings about meetings he held with a dozen or so young people. Certainly no public, let alone physical, antagonism between businessmen. And absolutely no runaways. No drinking. Even acknowledging his part in the town's
unraveling. Meisner was dissatisfied. Why such stubbornness, such venom against asserting rights, claiming a wider role in the affairs of black people? They, of all people, knew the necessity of unalloyed will, the rewards of courage and single-mindedness. Of all people, they understood the mechanisms of wresting power, didn't they? Over and over, with the least provocation, they pulled from their stock of stories tales about the old folks, their grands and great-grands, their fathers and mothers, dangerous confrontations, clever maneuvers, testimonies to endurance, wit, skill, and strength, tales of luck and outrage. But why were there no stories to tell of themselves? About their own lives, they shut up, had nothing to say, pass on, as though past heroism was enough of a future to live by, as though, rather than children, they wanted duplicates. Meisner was hoping for answers down there, on his knees, not a growing catalog of questions. So he did what he was accustomed to doing, asked him to come along as he struck out, late and agitated, for the wedding reception. Being in his company quieted anger. As he left the parsonage and turned into Central Avenue, he could hear the light breathing of his companion, but no word of advice or consolation. He was passing Harper's Drugstore when he saw a crowd gathered near the oven. From it, in a burst of tune-up needy engine roar, shot a Cadillac. In less than a minute it passed him, and he recognized two convent women among the passengers. By the time he got to Morgan's yard, the crowd had dispersed. The sugar-drunk children were racing and tumbling with steward's collies. The oven was deserted. The instant he stepped inside Sohn and Deke's house, he could see that all was aglow. Menace came forward to embrace him. Pulliam, Arnold, and Deke interrupted their deep conversation to shake his hand. The Careys were singing a duet, a chorus backing them. So he was not startled to see Jeff Fleetwood laughing pleasantly with the very man he had drawn a gun on some weeks ago, the freshly married groom. Only the bride looked askew. The silence in the Cadillac was not an embarrassed one. None of the passengers had high expectations of the men in suits, so they were not surprised to be asked to leave the premises. "Give these little girls their bicycles back," said one. "Get on out of here," said another, through a mouthful of tobacco. The younger men, who had laughed and cheered them on, were ordered away without words, just a look and head movement from a man 7 feet tall. Nor were they angry about the dismissal. Slightly put out, maybe, but not seriously. One, the driver, had never seen a man who didn't look like an unlit explosion. Another, in the front passenger seat, considered the boring sexual images she had probably incited and recommitted herself to making tracks to somewhere else. A third, who had really been having fun, sat in the back seat, thinking that although she knew what anger looked like, she had no idea what it might feel like. She always did what she was told. So when the man said, "Give these little girls," she did it with a smile. The fourth passenger was grateful for the expulsion. This was her second day at the convent, and the third day of having said not one word to anybody. Except today, when the girl, Billy something, came to stand near her. "You all right?" She wore a shell-pink gown, and instead of the shower cap, had tiny yellow roses pinned into her hair. "Pallas, you okay?" She nodded and tried not to shiver. "You're safe out there, but I'll come by to see you if you need anything, all right?" "Yes," Pallas whispered. "Then, thanks." So there. She had opened her lips a tiny bit to say two words, and no black water had seeped in. The cold still shook her bones, but the dark water had receded. For now. At night, of course, it would return, and she would be back in it, trying not to think about what swam below her neck. It was the top of the water she concentrated on, and the flashlight licking the edge, then darting farther out over the black glimmer, hoping the things touching below were sweet little goldfish like the ones in the bowl her father brought her when she was 5, or guppies, angels, not alligators or snakes. This was a lake, not a swamp, or the aquarium at the San Diego Zoo. Floating over the water, the whispers were closer than their calls. Here, pussy, kitty, 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 sounded far away. But gimme the flash, dickface. Is that her? Let go. Maybe she drowned. No way. Slid into the skin behind her ears. Pallas stared out of the window at a sky so steady, landscape so featureless, she had no sense of being in a moving car. The smell of Gigi's bubblegum mixed with her cigarette smoke was nauseating. Here, pussy, here. Pallas had heard that before, a lifetime ago, on the happiest day of her life, on the escalator, last Christmas, spoken by the crazy woman, whom she could see now in greater detail than when first sighted. The hair at the top of her head, sectioned off with a red plastic barrette, would have been a small pompadour or a curl had it been longer than 2 or 3 inches. In the event, it was neither, just a tuft, held rigid by a child's barrette. The 2 other hair clips, one yellow, one neon purple, held fingerfuls of hair at her temples. Her dark velvet face was on display and rendered completely unseen by the biscuit-sized discs of scarlet rouge. The fuchsia lipstick, drawn crookedly beyond the rim of her lips, the black eyebrow pencil that trailed down toward her cheekbones. Everything else about her was dazzle and clunk. White plastic earrings, copper bracelets, pastel beads at her throat, and much, much more were all that came from in the bag she carried. 2 BOAC carrier bags and a woven metal purse shaped like a cigar box. She wore a white cotton halter and a little bitty red skirt. The hose on her short legs, a cinnamon color thought agreeable to black women's legs, were as much a study in running as her high heels were in run over. Inner arm skin and a small, sturdy paunch suggested she was about 40 years old, but she could have been 50 or 20. The dance she danced on the up escalator, the rolling hips, the sway of her head, called to mind a bygone era of slow grind in a badly lit room of couples. Not the electric go-go pace of 1974. The teeth could have been done anywhere, Kingston, Jamaica, or past Christian, Mississippi, Addis Ababa, or Warsaw. Stunning gold, they dated her smile while giving it the seriousness the rest of her clothing withheld. Most eyes looked away from her, down at the floating metal steps underfoot, or out at the Christmas decorations enlivening the department store. Children, however, and palace true love stared. California Christmases are always a treat, and this one promised to be a marvel. Brilliant skies and heat turned up the gloss of artificial snow, plumped the green and gold, pink and silver wreaths. Palace, laden with packages, just managed to avoid tripping off the down escalator. She didn't understand why the woman with the rouge and gold teeth fascinated her. They had nothing in common. The earrings that hung from Palace's lobes were 18 carat. The boots on her feet were handmade, her jeans custom made, and the buckle on her leather belt was handsomely worked silver. Palace had stumbled off the escalator in a light panic, rushing to the doors, outside which Carlos was waiting for her. The revolting woman's sing-song merged with the carols piping throughout the store. "Here's pussy. Want some pussy, pussy?" "Mavis." Mavis wouldn't look at her. Gigi always uglied up her name, pulling it out like a string of her sticky bubble gum. "Can't you go over 10 miles an hour? Christ! Car needs a new fan belt, and I'm not going to take it over 40, said Mavis. 10, 40, it's like walking, Gigi sighed. "Maybe I'll just pull over here and let you see what walking's like. Want me to?" "Don't fuck with me. Drag me out to that bummer. Did you see that guy, Seth? Menace, the one who shit himself when he stayed with us." Seneca nodded. "He didn't say anything mean, though." "He didn't stop them either," said Gigi. "All that puke, that shit I cleaned up." "Connie said he could stay, and we all cleaned it," said Mavis. "Not just you, and nobody dragged you. You didn't have to go." "He had the DTs, for crying out loud." "Close your window, please, Mavis," Seneca asked. "Too much wind back there?" "She's shaking again. I think she's cold." "It's 90 degrees. What the hell is the matter with her?" Gigi scanned the trembling girl. "Should I stop?" asked Mavis. "She might throw up again." "No, don't stop. I'll hold her." Seneca arranged Palace in her arms, rubbing the goosebumpy arms. "Maybe she's carsick. I thought the party would cheer her up some. Looks like it made her worse. That stupid, fucked-up town make anybody puke. I can't believe that's what they call a party. Hymns, for crying out loud." Gigi laughed. "It was a wedding party, not a disco." Mavis wiped the perspiration forming under her neck. "Besides, you just wanted to see your love pony again." "That asshole." "Yeah, him," Mavis smiled. "Now he's married, you want him back?" "If I want him back, I can get him back. What I want is to leave this fucking place." "You've been saying that for 4 years. Right, Sen?" Gigi opened her mouth, then paused. Was it 4? She thought 2. But at least 2 were spent fooling around with KD, the prick. Had she let him keep her that long, promising to get enough money to take her away? Or was it some other promise that kept her there, of trees entwined near cold water? "Yeah, well, now I'm for real," she told Mavis, and hoped she really was. After a grunt of disbelief from Mavis, the car was silent again. Palace let her head rest on Seneca's breasts, wishing they were gone, and that instead Carlos's hard, smooth chest supported her cheek as it had whenever she wanted for 700 miles. Her 16th birthday gift, a red Toyota with a built-in 8-track tape deck,
was crammed with Christmas presents, things anybody's mother would like, but in a variety of colors and styles, because she couldn't take a chance on having nothing that would please a woman she had not seen in 13 years. Driving off with Carlos at the wheel just before Christmas was a holiday trip to see her mother, not running away from her father, not eloping with the coolest, most gorgeous man in the world. Everything had been carefully planned. Items were hidden, movements camouflaged, lest Providence, the eagle-eyed housekeeper, or her brother Jerome, see. Her father wasn't around enough to notice anything. He was a lawyer with a small client list, but two were big-time crossover black entertainers. As long as Milton Truelove kept them on top, he didn't need to acquire more, although he kept a lookout eye for other young performers who might hit the charts and stay there. With Carlos's help, it was as easy as it was exciting. The lies told to her girlfriends had to be cemented. The items left behind had to signal return, not escape. Driver's license, a duplicate. Her teddy bears, watch, toiletries, jewelry, credit cards. This last made it necessary to do massive check cashing and shopping on the very day they drove away. She wanted to buy more, much more, for Carlos, but he insisted otherwise. He never took presents from her in all the time she knew him, 4 months. Wouldn't even let her buy meals. He would close his beautiful eyes and shake his head as though her offer saddened him. Pallas had met him in the school parking lot the day her Toyota wouldn't start. Actually met him that day, but had seen him many times. He was the movie star-looking maintenance man at her high school. All the girls went creamy over him. The day he pressed the accelerator to the floor, telling Pallas her gas line was flooded, was the beginning. He offered to follow her home in his Ford to make sure she didn't stall out again. She didn't, and he waved goodbye. Pallas brought him a present, an album, the next day, and had trouble making him accept it. "Only if you let me buy you a chili dog," he said. Pallas's mouth had gone felt with the thrill of it all. They saw each other every weekend after that. She did everything she could think of to get him to make love to her. He responded passionately to their necking, but for weeks never allowed more. He was the one who said, "When we are married." Carlos was not a janitor, really. He sculpted. And when Pallas told him about her painter mother and where she lived, he smiled and said it was a perfect place for an artist. The whole thing fell into place. Carlos could leave his job with little outcry during the holidays. Milton Truelove would be extra busy with clients, parties, showcase concerts, and television deals. Pallas searched through years of birthday and Christmas cards from her mother for the most recent address, and the lovers were off without a hitch or a cloud, except for the crazy black woman ruining the Christmas carols. Pallas snuggled Seneca's breasts, which, although uncomfortable, diluted the chill racking her. The women in the front seat were quarreling again in high-pitched voices that hurt her head. "Exhibitionist bitch. Someone is a friend of ours. What do I tell her now? She's Connie's friend. Nothing to do with you. I'm the one sell her the peppers, make up her tonic. What does that make you, a chemist? It's just rosemary. A little bran mixed with aspirin. Whatever it is, it's my responsibility.
Only when Connie's drunk. Keep your nasty mouth off her. She never drank till you came. That's what you say. She even sleeps in the wine cellar. Her bedroom is down there. You're such a fool. She's not a maid anymore. She could sleep upstairs if she wanted. She just wants to be close to that liquor is all. God, I hate your guts. Seneca intervened in a soft voice designed for harmony. Connie's not drunk. She's unhappy. She should have come with us, though. It would have been different. It was fine, just fine, said Gigi, till those fucking preacher types came over. She lit a fresh cigarette from a dying one. Can't you stop smoking for 2 minutes? Mavis asked. No. Don't see what that nigger ever saw in you, Mavis continued. Or maybe I do, since you can't seem to keep it covered. Jealous? Like hell. Like hell, like hell. Nobody's fucked you in 10 years, you dried up husk. Get out, Mavis screamed, breaking the car. Get the hell out of my car. You gonna make me? Touch me, I'll tear your face off, you fucking felon. And she rammed her cigarette into Mavis's arm.